Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Gwyn Sheltimer, my co-host Felicity Signal-Reed, and our guest this week, Renee Schmidt. Each week at this time, we visit with an author, sometimes an editor or a publisher from our region, anybody connected with the world of words. We try to find out a little bit about their lives, what prompts them to write or create, and give them an opportunity to share their work. Today, we're very pleased to have Renee Schmidt join us. Welcome, Renee.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Renee is the author of four books of nonfiction about Canadian disasters. The first of these sold over 57,000 copies. The most recent, published in 2013, is called Canadian Disasters, 43 True Stories. His novel, Leaving Fletchville, published in 2008, was highly recommended by several reviews and was the Red Maple Honor Book in 2010. He's also written numerous articles for magazines and professional journals. Renee was born in Zaandam, Holland, and came to Canada when he was 3 years old. He held a wide variety of jobs before his desire to write and teach took him back to university. He's now retired from teaching, but continues to write and to act as the part-time director of a youth drop-in center in Brighton. Renee, your first book was a phenomenal commercial success, 57,000 copies. How did you get it published?
Well, that's quite an interesting story, Gwyn. It was really, I call it a God thing, because I just happened to be at the right place at the right time, but I think there was more to it than that. I was teaching, and I was writing fiction stories for my students to motivate them. I was teaching remedial reading, and many of them hated reading so much. To motivate them, I started writing stories about them using their own names. So I'd make them into the hero, the protagonist, whatever, just to motivate them. And years before that, I had graduated from York University's creative writing program, which was quite a fine program. I had excellent writers as mentors, and they really encouraged me in my writing. I had tried to make a living as a writer upon graduation, and I found that very difficult. And eventually, the rent had to be paid, and the student loans had to be paid off, and I needed food on my plate, so I turned to teaching and driving taxi on weekends just to earn money. Anyway, there was a salesman from Scholastic that I began talking with, and I told him about my manuscripts that I was using to motivate my students, and he seemed interested and asked to look at them. He, in turn, brought them to editors at Scholastic. And it wasn't until years later that I realized how significant this was, because I believe his name was Bill. The Scholastic just doesn't do that. They don't take unsolicited manuscripts, and they really don't deal with unknown people. So they had a look at them, they liked them, but they said they came back and the story that they looked at that they were interested in was too long for the magazine, too short for a book. But they said, we're looking for someone who would write about Canadian disasters. Well, my first reaction was, wow, what a lugubrious kind of topic, like just blood and guts and gore. And then a second later, the penny dropped and I realized this was exactly the kind of thing that my reluctant readers actually would pick up and
right.
Start to read.
Yeah. So do you think disasters are particularly interest to the young, or is it the heroic side of saving people and all that sort of stuff that attracts them?
Well, I'm afraid it's the disasters itself. Yeah. And I think we all, as humans, we have a fascination with the bad news. There is a psychological component to that, I believe. Part of my training courses in teaching was looking at children's literature and the original Grimm's fairy tales. And they used to be a lot more bloodthirsty.
Mm-hmm.
There was lots more of cutting off of limbs and plucking out of eyes by birds and
yes.
Nasty things like that. And there was a deliberate reason for that, because in the old days, this was how children dealt with their fears. Today we have television and other things that scare us. But back in the day, scary stories were the only way kids could really confront their fears and overcome them or plan what they would do if something happened to them. The blood and the gore was very much a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
So disasters still fascinate us.
Yeah, and I think survival is a universal thing too. We all will wonder, if it happened to us, what
yes.
would we do?
Exactly.
So these are Canadian disasters, Canadian history. Do you think that the recent increase in historical novels set in Canada will also make younger people more interested in our Canadian history?
Well, I think it's excellent. There are so many good series now. Scholastic has published several called I Am Canada and Dear Canada. There's many books coming out that have that are historically accurate, but also are based in Canada. As a nation of one-tenth the population of the USA, of course, we're still overwhelmed with a lot of American history and a lot of American news. And so there's always room for more information on Canadian history. And I do find that we don't know our history as well as we might, but things are certainly improving. TV shows like Murdoch Mysteries and stuff like that are very well done, and I think that really is good, too, for Canadian history.
Great. Well, we'd love to hear you read from one of your collections of Canadian disasters. I guess, do I have to warn our listeners about gore and things, or are we going to have a fairly gentle...
Well, this one is actually very current. Actually, the story, it is and it isn't. The story is a little bit out of date, but what I want to read from is from the Franklin Expedition. And if you've been following the news just two days ago, they announced the discovery of the Terror. Now, the Erebus, the original one of the two ships to be discovered, it was discovered just less than a year after my latest disaster book came out. I had written about the Franklin Expedition. I had done lots of research on it. At the time when I wrote it and when the book was published, neither of the two ships had been found. I found the story fascinating. It is very Canadian and it's very current in the sense that Prime Minister Stephen Harper was getting people to look for those ships, and there was a real active effort out there to find them. So I'm just going to read just a few little bits from those stories. I'm going to jump around a bit because some of it is just setting the story, setting the scene where it was. But to start here. It was discovered later that Franklin's ships sailed west more than 1,500 kilometers, passing between Baffin and Devon Islands. They reached Beachy Island, where inscriptions on three lonely graves and litter, including a pile of empty tin cans, tell of a winter spent there. A plateau of rock gave some protection from the groaning slabs of sea ice that could crush a ship. The long Arctic winter was passed indoors, with the men working in lamplight to scrub the decks, repair gear, and venturing out to chop holes in ice for water. Water was always needed because fire on the ship was a sailor's greatest fear. Though it was seldom warm enough for the mariners to venture out to hunt for fresh meat, they were too far north to find game anyway. On New Year's Day of 1846, a boyish 20-year-old coal stoker on the Terror, John Torrington, died. His shipmates hacked for hours through the iron-hard frozen ground to bury the young man's remains. Just 3 days later, John Hartnell of the Erebus died suddenly as well. 90 days later, another man from the Erebus, a marine named William Brain, also died. When the summer thaw melted the sea ice, Franklin's two ships sailed south, but only got a few hundred kilometers before getting trapped into September sea ice. Now they were in a much worse location than the winter before, being 40 kilometers from the shore of King William Island and exposed to the bitter wind. Both ships would also be at the mercy of the kilometers-wide expanses of sea ice that sometimes shifted and crushed ships. The two ships spent their second winter there. It was normal for British Navy ships on exploration missions to leave dozens of messages giving their location and progress for other ships to find, but only two messages about Franklin's expedition were ever found. The first note, left in a cairn of piled rocks on King William Island in May of 1847, described the first winter at Beachy Island and the second winter spent off King William Island. It said all was well. But just a few months after that hopeful message, all was not well. Franklin died in June of 1847, and the leadership of the expedition passed to Captain Crozier of the Terror. Worse, the summer thaw of ice never came. Sunshine warmed the air, taunting the men with the possibility of sailing on, but the ice held fast. Winter returned in full force by September. Not only were the men trapped in the same location for another winter, but more of them began to die. According to the second note left a year later, 9 other officers and 15 of the crew also perished. The cause of death was not given. The final part of the message, written in shaky handwriting, revealed that the men had abandoned the ships and were heading south for Back's Fish River. This meant a nearly impossible journey of almost 1,000 kilometers over the ice and through the most barren land imaginable. Years later, at various places along the shore of King William Island, searchers found skeletons, heavy wooden rowboats, and jumbled piles of useless items such as books, curtain rods, and iron stoves. Sailors from the two ships apparently took much effort to drag almost everything of value across 40 kilometers of ice. Why did they abandon their ships? Were the ships in danger of sinking? How would curtain rods and books help men survive? At least one group of about 40 men journeyed to the southern end of King William Island. They were seen in July 1848 by Inuit hunters who traded the starving men a small seal, all the food they could spare. 100 kilometers further, having reached Canada's mainland, 35 or 40 men camped at what is now Starvation Cove on Adelaide Peninsula. I'll just read just from John Ray, who is a Scottish trapper and traveler. He was one of the few who knew how to travel in the Arctic, how he described the finding of the remains of these last of Franklin's men. Some of the bodies were in tents. Others were under the boat, which had been turned over to form a shelter. And some lay scattered. From the mutilated state of many of the bodies and the contents of the cooking pots, it is evident that our wretched countrymen had been driven to the dread alternative of cannibalism as a means of sustaining life.
Ooh, that is pretty grim. But I guess, you know, it's been known to happen many times.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Renee. We've been talking to Renee Schmidt, historian and novelist, and now we'll take a short break.